a lot of these big companies had programs to develop wireless sensors to go attack machine health in the balance of plant of factories. What I would say we invented is basically an approach that works that's ultimately scalable. So we really got into this game. We were doing applications on helicopters and submarines for the Navy, things for the Army, on prosthetic limbs. And we had basically built technology that could be deployed at scale at a relatively low cost.
Budget overruns, brick devices, data breaches. Building connected products is hard. Welcome to Over the Air, sharp, unfiltered conversations with executives about their IoT journeys, the mistakes they made, the lessons they learned, and what they wish they'd known when they started. I'm your host, Ryan Prosser. Welcome back to Over the Air, IoT connected devices and the journey. My name is Ryan Prosser, CEO of Verri. And today we're joined by Jeremy Frank, CEO of KCF Technologies. We're going to be talking about industrial IoT, predictive maintenance, and bootstrapping a hardware company. Jeremy, thanks for being on the show.
Really glad to be here, Ryan. Nice to meet you.
All right. So give us a little background on the company before we get started.
Well, we're 23 years old and counting. I founded the company. It came out of a lab at Penn State University called the Center for Acoustics and Vibration. No formal affiliation, but that's where we were born, just kind of real depth in vibration and noise and machine dynamics. I got my PhD there with a professor by the name of Gary Koopman in 2000.
So you guys are bootstrapped. I think you mentioned 23 years as CEO. Not unprecedented, but very unusual. You know, we've only had a small number of people on the show that fit the profile. I think actually our pilot episode, dozens and dozens of episodes, Backtrack, another company where the founder bootstrapped it, and then I think maybe nothing in the middle. Tell us a little bit about that process. I mean, it's extremely unusual and impressive. Off the air, I was talking, you and I were joking about sea turtles. This is like a lot of them hatch. Most of them don't make it to the ocean. Fewer still make it, you know, their first week of life. 23 years later, I mean, it's like a vanishingly small segment of a million bootstrapped companies would still exist. How'd you guys do it? What's that story look like?
Try to draw that metaphor. I think what I said is that if you are a hatched sea turtle and you're trying to make it to the water, it's very difficult. It's very scary. Your chances of death are very high. And that's kind of the bootstrap path. But if you compare it to the VC path of a turtle, it would be more like to juice it up with steroids and put rockets on the shell and try to launch it into outer space right away. It is interesting that that's sort of the prevailing wisdom of our time, that that's the right way to grow a fledgling business. I don't think it is, but whether I'm old-fashioned or something else, I don't know, but that's the way we did it. From my point of view, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but my father was an entrepreneur also. So I grew up around the kind of the spirit of entrepreneurship. He never scaled his business. He was essentially a sole proprietor. But for me, getting a job and working in a formal job, a salary job at a corporation would have been unusual. So starting a company was usual to me. Get the idea of like raising VC money and getting investment honestly never occurred to me. I just didn't. My dad was definitely a model for me, but I also, that would have felt to me like getting a job. You know, if I was going to have somebody looking over my shoulder and holding me accountable for things, not that that's unhealthy necessarily with 20 years of perspective now, it would have been healthy in a lot of ways. However, I just had no interest in it.
Talk about some of those early days. I mean, I know it took you guys some time to actually get a my words, not yours, a viable commercialized product to market. So you kind of went through kind of a grant route. There was some incubate. What did that story look like?
It took us a decade to have the viable product that the whole company is riding on now. But it took us 12 hours to have a viable service offering. We basically were consultants. Like I said, we came from an area of deep expertise at the Center of Excellence within Penn State. And literally the day after we founded the company, we had our first paying customer. We flew out to California and we were doing testing on a dynamometer at the Pirelli Tire Test Center in Visalia, California. And it was a consulting gig for another company that was testing out their product. And that was our first customer. And we sort of scaled through a series of things like that that were relatively lucrative at the time, but were paying the bills and starting to give some scale. We mainly grew. That could have been a company. It wasn't really where I wanted to take things as it evolved. And so what you reference is that we started competing for and winning R&D contracts for the government, primarily with the Small Business Innovation Research Program. And really, that's how we scaled the company to a couple million dollars of revenue kind of over that first decade of operation.
Yeah, it's interesting. You say 12 years to get a product, 12 hours to get a service offering pulled together. Again, I'm paraphrasing. You know, the parent company of this podcast, Very, of which I'm the CEO, sees this every day. That like to pull together a service-oriented business, to do it well is hard, but to get it going, you know, the barrier to getting started is relatively low. And I'm surprised that more entrepreneurs don't pursue that path. Having now gone through it, it does seem like a tremendous opportunity to avoid venture capital, build a business, learn a lot about product market fit from the front lines, and then go forward. It sounds like that was some version of you guys' experience.
You know, absolutely. It's funny because I was going through some other examples in my mind of bootstrapped entrepreneurs, because you're right. The perception is that that's unusual. I'm not convinced it actually is unusual, but it's certainly the perception in tech is that, you know, the first thing you got to do is go make your pitch and raise money. But I definitely, when I talk to entrepreneurship classes, that's something that I do say is that it, just starting with a services offering is far easier than what people mostly think of, which is to invent some widget that no one's ever seen before, whether it's software or hardware. But it's related. I think it is smarter to start off with services, but it's not that unusual. I was thinking of a few companies in our space. Pat Kennedy founded a company called OSI Soft. They're big like Pi software. I actually got to know him and had some conversations, but he basically did the same thing. Had some expertise, came out of another part. He was working, not coming out of academia, but had some expertise and put his expertise at play in the context of some, I think it was oil and gas customers. And that's how that company got their start. And they were bootstrapped for 40 years before they ultimately took investment and sold to Aviva. And there's other examples like that, that I personally think, if you look at successful companies, not just all startups, but successful startups, I think there's a grittiness and a resilience that is shared among a lot of the successful companies.
I'm going to try to seamlessly pivot us now or transition us to the next topic I want to ask you about, which is KCF current day. Or maybe this is like the transition time into current day. So you guys, pretty interesting in this machine health category, credited by some as maybe having invented the category or being a heavy participant in it. Talk about that a little bit. And like, as you guys went from service oriented, you said it took you guys some time to get there. Talk about the next chapter after that for you guys and this category. I know that others got there first, but didn't seem to have quite gotten it right. What did that look like from your perspective?
So let's say the machine health category, it would be a stretch. I mean, so I've never quite looked at it this way. It would be a stretch to say we invented the machine health category without further explanation. So I want to clarify something because that means a lot to different people and it requires clarification. But I would say that we invented the machine health category in the way that it's implemented, the approach that we take, and what is being scaled successfully. And there's nuance to it. But just to roll back the clock a little bit, Don Bentley is, I think, one of the people credited with starting basically using vibration in the 60s, 1960s, that Bentley Nevada, he started that company. And they were using vibration monitoring sensors, eddy current probes, to monitor machine vibrations and scaled it. It became really that's the company that really defined vibration monitoring, predictive maintenance, and scaled. Interestingly enough, also bootstrapped, had a pretty autonomous mindset, and grew that company for 40 years until he sold it to GE. And if you go a little further along, you know, condition-based maintenance and vibration, it wasn't just Bentley Nevada, but I think they were the most successful company doing what we do in industry. But within the Department of Defense, within the aircraft, ships, submarines, helicopters, condition-based maintenance became pretty mature in, I would say, maybe the 70s into the 80s, using vibration sensors to look at engine health, for example. And we were actually part of some of those, you know, when we were doing DoD contracts in the 2000s, we were part of some of those efforts. And those things, even on commercial aircraft, vibration monitoring and predictive maintenance for machine health is very mature. Then the next step, there were companies, CSI, which ultimately got acquired by Emerson, is one of the important ones that basically built portable tools, like portable data acquisition tools, around the time when laptops became ubiquitous, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. And that sort of democratized vibration monitoring. It wasn't just on helicopters and engines. You could walk around a factory and take vibration and improve the health of your machines, predict failures. So all of that precedes us. If you were to try to say we invented the machine health category, we're standing on top of all of those things. But what happened next is interesting, and this is where I think it's relevant. Not much happened from a technology success deployment standpoint. There's maybe a 10 or more year lull. But there was a lot of talk. There was a lot of Internet of Things type talk in the 2000s. In fact, some people lose track of the fact that there were companies like Crossbow and Ember, MicroStrain were some of the companies we looked up to when we started that were doing wireless sensors for factories, basically machine health. And in various ways, they went kind of different directions or they sort of flamed out. And the bigger companies were doing it too. I mean, GE, Emerson, Honeywell, a lot of these big companies had programs to develop wireless sensors to go attack machine health in the balance of plant of factories. What I would say we invented is basically an approach that works that's ultimately scalable. So we really got into this game. We were doing applications on helicopters and submarines for the Navy, things for the Army, on prosthetic limbs. And we had basically built technology that could be deployed at scale at a relatively low cost. But in about a little over 10 years ago, like 2011, 2010, what we did is we started deploying that into actual industrial settings and getting close enough to the problem that we realized that something different had to happen to actually solve the machine health problem and kind of attack it with a different approach. And it's that approach that I would say we really figured out, and that has caused us to scale into the machine health category.
When we were talking offline, this was one of the threads I enjoyed the most. Predictive maintenance is something we talk a lot about on this show. And I think it's kind of, in a way, carrying commercial IoT right now. It's where a lot of people start. If you're out there listening in the audience and your company makes hardware and like heavy equipment, whatever, and there isn't a predictive maintenance strategy, most people would say you're in deep shit. Jeremy's take is a little spicier. I'll characterize it badly, and then you can own your own narrative here. It's broken. It's not the right approach. People are thinking about it wrong. It seemed to be, you know, when we were talking before, talk about your opinion of predictive maintenance. Let's get a hot take here. This will be our sizzle reel that we promote to this episode with. But like Jeremy's take on this is pretty hot.
Well, so I think when you talk about predictive maintenance, I was just at we do a lot of work in the auto manufacturing industry. I was at a meeting in Detroit a couple months ago. And one of the things I noted is that, to your point, a lot of people were using this phrase, pilot purgatory. And that's now. I mean, that's in 2013. Pilot purgatory in terms of deploying predictive maintenance. And you're right. I think it is machine health is the single biggest realized value category within IoT, or at least one of the dominant successes. But that is not to imply that most people who deploy it are enjoying it. And it's because they're going about it the wrong way. When I would say the wrong way, there's one fundamental thing and there's nuance to it, but it's basically whenever I see a company that's purely focusing on the technology, whether it's a big data approach or it's strictly throwing AI tools at all the data and you're going to solve the problem, or even sensor, you know, making autonomous systems that implement a solution that eliminates the problem altogether. Those things have a history in this space of not being scalable and hanging in pilot purgatory. And I think the thing that they leave out is people. That's just at the basic level. And there's different, you know, I could go back to what we actually did in terms of our learnings and our technology. I can give you an example, but it's basically building technology that elevates people. That is what is needed to actually drive change in the critical industries that we serve. Now, it's different. You know, if you're Boeing and you're trying to make sure your engine is healthy, it's a very different problem. It's a very sophisticated piece of machinery, but you have total control over it. And it's just a different type of problem. If you're going into a big, smelly, dirty factory that's some of the machines have been there for 50 years or 80 years, and you have a bunch of people coming in and out of those in the factory doing maintenance and operating things, that's the environment that we're delivering technology into. And because of that, if you don't build technology that elevates those people who are going in, sometimes inadvertently causing problems, whether it's operators or maintainers, but you know, usually with good intent trying to improve things, but also there are just these very challenging, complex problems. If you try to treat it as a technology problem without elevating the people to make them better problem solvers, you're just never going to get something that scales. At least I don't believe you are. And I think that's the most fundamental thing that's caused our success. There's one thing that's really, don't take my word for it, it's really you could say all of that is just copied directly out of the Toyota playbook, or, you know, lean Kaizen is just, you rely on people, the people at the Gemba, the people at the front line. Those are the people that can solve the problems. And essentially, that's what we basically build a solution for and figured out, is that if you build technology that makes those people super solvers, like Kaizen in the hands of tech, like a technology capability in their hands, that's how you can do something at scale and with much greater participation and collaboration between different types of people within a factory setting. And that's what I've seen is the difference between something that works at scale and something that dies.
And just to get on that Toyota principle, I think a lot of people know this probably by heart, but just to bring everybody up to speed.
On Kaizen?
Yeah, I mean, I know you're a big fan, and you've had, I think, the individual behind this on your podcast a couple of times, but can you talk about some of the impetus behind the concept?
I won't try to speak to the fundamentals of lean manufacturing or Toyota's TPM, TPS. But what I would say is that the fundamental belief is in eliminating waste through continuous improvement, and specifically the people who are closest to the value creation, or the Japanese term is Gemba, the people who are closest to the assembly line or the production, those are the people that can notice waste and eliminate it and do the various things. You know, there's various levels to what is defined as the Lexus slogan, the relentless pursuit of perfection, is largely that's what's embodied in Toyota's approach to manufacturing. But it's all about making just incremental, continuous improvements, Kaizen, to eliminate waste and improve the rate and quality of production. And it was sort of a theory in maybe the 60s or the 70s, and it was borrowed from things that had happened before that, but it works. The point is that it works, and it causes Toyota to have outsized success in terms of their production and quality that other companies have emulated. Now, there's almost all good manufacturing companies have elements of lean manufacturing that they build into their manufacturing processes. My point is really just that taking that, which is really traditionally a pretty methodical, somewhat slow manual process, and you supercharge that with technology, that's where I think you really get something. That's where you elevate people to do these things much more quickly at scale.
You said Toyota. I'm going to ask you a totally unrelated question. It's related to Toyota, but not this episode. Toyota has placed one of the most fascinating non-bets that I've ever seen. And if the last 40 years, at least, is their rise to being the second most valuable car brand is due to this total mastery of lean, the next chapter seems like it's going to be tied, if not totally highly, at least, to their bet on a thing not happening, which is electric cars. They're notably absent from this moment in time. This is not what this episode is about, but Jeremy Frank always has an interesting take on things. What do you think when people are listening to this episode 2030 and the story has really started to play out fully? You're seeing it having now played out instead of it, currently it's in front of us. What are people going to be saying from the vantage point of 2030 about Toyota and their non-bet in this moment? Or I guess you could say their bet on ICE, internal combustion engine, being very resilient and having longer legs, I guess, or coattails than people are currently here in the end of 2023 giving it credit for. What's your take on what people are going to be saying end of the decade?
It's an interesting topic for me, of course, and I've read about it a little bit, and so I can speculate and combine that with just things I've read. I mean, first of all, Toyota is a very thoughtful company, and they have a long track record of consistent success. However, they have a track record of being not wanting to be the first ones to adopt. They're rarely the first adopter, specifically in regard to technology. They like to watch what happens and then basically perfect it. And I think that's part of what's happening here. Now, one interesting reality that people, I think, forget about is that the Toyota Prius, if you look at it in terms of the electric powertrain on a vehicle at scale, I don't know the percentages, but it vastly dominates the deployment of electric battery-driven powertrain. It's just that it's combined with an engine. And even having plug-in hybrids, you're right that they're appearing like they're a little bit late to the game in terms of going all in on battery electric vehicles. But in actuality, they have been working at it and in it longer than most anyone with great success. Exactly what happens next, I don't know. I would just say, you know, I know that they do have a thoughtful perspective on this. And I've read, you know, Akio Toyoda talked about basically that it's a more efficient deployment of battery capacity at scale is to merge it, like battery plug-in hybrid vehicles rather than full-on electric vehicles, because you can achieve a much more dramatic change in the overall sustainability of the global auto system. I'm not an expert in that, but something behind that is informing their path. And whether they're right or wrong, I really don't know, because they have a history of being conservative, specifically about technology deployment and development. And sometimes that's right and sometimes that's wrong. And I think it's a little early to say.
One of my favorite case studies in technology is BlackBerry and RIM, the parent company of BlackBerry. And for people listening out there that are 35 or younger, I mean, they probably don't know what a BlackBerry is. Certainly if they're under 30, they don't know what a BlackBerry is. Maybe they have some faint memory of one of their parents having one briefly at the, you know, in their career. But I mean, look, we'll move on because I want to ask more questions about KCF. But it, the Prius did seem like this winning platform, just like BlackBerry was this winning platform from which to then go push into this super interesting sector. And BlackBerry didn't seem to be able to, I have full disclosure of not seeing the new movie about it. I know a lot of people like it. It's very interesting. But BlackBerry totally ceded the most important consumer category of all time to the point of fading away into nothing. And I was just very surprised to see Toyota not build on that platform, not push their success forward, frankly, like your company has done, take success, build on it. And it just seemed like such a spicy bet. I'm very curious to see how this decade plays out, because it seems like by the end of this decade, that's either going to look like one of the genius non-bets of all time, or it's going to look very BlackBerry-ish, in my opinion, because they had this huge lead with the Prius. I know it was nickel metal hydride. That's different, but they did move to lithium. And anyways, okay, let's have you back on the show and do nothing but this topic. Let me bring it back to the company that you're running. So what's next for you guys? Been in this 23 years, you've built a fantastic company. What's next for you guys? People are going to be listening to this episode, Q1 2024. What are some of the things coming down the pipe that you're excited about?
Oh, well, just scale and impact. And the reason I wanted control over the business and bootstrap it from the beginning is I was really motivated to build technology that elevates people. The focal point of that has changed a few times over the years, and it's been all in on the machine health problem at scale since about 13, 14 years ago now. And so it's just bigger and more is what's on our horizon from a general standpoint. I mean, I would actually go back when we were talking about the machine health category and figuring out basically how to elevate people with technology. We really figured that out in kind of an unusual place, kind of the opposite of Toyota in a sense, is upstream oil and gas, hydraulic fracturing. And fracking at the time was almost a dirty word. You know, this is 2010, 2011. But we learned this process, basically how to put technology in the hands of people, give them data they never had access to, and go proactively attack the problems that are burning a hole in their pocket and creating dangerous situations and creating a lot of unnecessary waste. And it works. The interesting thing is those people in the oil field of the hollows of West Virginia and out in West Texas, those people are very motivated to solve problems and very innovative and very well led, in my experience, more so than what we see in a typical factory where things are more stable. And so it caused us to learn things that are scalable and relevant everywhere. Okay, so now fast forward back to 2024. It's just the cat is out of the bag now. You know, as you said, I think even though most companies aren't necessarily enjoying it, there's enough companies enjoying major economic benefits with predictive maintenance and workforce resilience, which is probably the single biggest motivator, and elimination of waste. I mean, just the elimination of waste that's possible, that's related to proactive machine health, is massive. It's massive beyond what most people's understanding is. And so what's next for us is just to take those learnings in that technology platform, we call it a comprehensive machine health platform, and just scale it as rapidly and with the maximum impact that we can over the next 5-10 years.
Last question. We're already over time, but I love this conversation. We got to have you back on the show, man. Last question. This is a total curveball, not giving you any prep that this is coming. We usually do an end of year predictions episode that we've recorded December. We'd air it in January. We didn't do it this year because, man, we've been on the road. I don't know if you've seen the recent episodes, but we are on the road talking with people on the road. So you are my predictions episode. Give us one hot take for 2024, something you think that we're going to see in 2024 in the world of technology, IoT. I mean, I'll throw a few things out there, but Cybertruck. This is going to be the biggest product launch of all time. It's currently rolling out now. Are they going to recall all these because this is the biggest dud of all time? If you're listening to this episode, July 2024, are they happy with their Cybertruck? Is this the biggest piece of aluminum, non-mobilized junk or any other topic? What's something that you think is going to play out in 2024? Send the folks into the new year with a hot take here. By the way, it is already the new year for them listening because this isn't going to air until January.
I would say in 2024, so I've been driving a full electric vehicle for 5-6 years now. And I see a lot of debate about it. The Cybertruck is one thing. It's really a niche, but it serves a niche. But the broader adoption of electric vehicles, I think, is something that is playing out in real time. And basically, all those companies are our customers. And on the manufacturing side, in the plants, there's all this hype. It's going really fast. But then you see people debating and the rate of production and orders are slowing down and inventories are building up. I would tell you, I think be happening substantially. It's already happening. People are just sort of not seeing enough facts. Electric vehicles are just better. They're just straight up better. And interestingly enough, I think people fear the most about them is range anxiety. In fact, my experience and most people I talk to, I actually have gas station anxiety now because the biggest change to your lifestyle is you don't have to go to the gas station. You just plug it in at your house and it's wonderful. It's a great change, but they're also faster. They're also quieter. They're also cleaner. And they're just better. And I think you're going to see that play out because it's such a large changeover and there's infrastructure and people's habits and preferences. I don't know how much it'll play out by the end of 2024, but I just think the wide scale adoption of electric vehicles, I mean, I've been saying this 5 years now when I kind of was, you know, my eyes were opened up to it. But that's the thing. It's just going to happen. It's just better.
I totally agree. And I live in Montana. And for a variety of reasons, we lag on adoption. One of them is temperature, which is a fair point. Lithium doesn't like to be cold, but it's very interesting. And the quote unquote sharing, so as we sit here in 2023, Airbnb ain't doing so great. The big cities are starting to crack down. And range anxiety and Airbnb, I've thought for a while, share this uncommon DNA in that I've wondered for some time, what is the value in owning a house that has more bedrooms than you have day in, day out occupants. So I have my wife, two kids, so three bedrooms makes sense, maybe even one more for occasion. But beyond that, purchase and rent additional capacity via Airbnb. So like on those rare occasions when you have someone, doesn't it make more sense to go that way? And on this range anxiety business, I've really come around to, does it not make sense to just purchase? Batteries are expensive. Lithium's expensive. And that is doesn't seem like that cost is going down anytime soon. Does it not make sense to purchase a car that makes sense for your day in, day out life and then go rent for those long road trips when you're going to go to Tahoe, upstate, blah, 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 whatever? You know, because otherwise you're purchasing this asset that, I don't know, 350 out of 365 you don't use. It pencils out if you go pencil the paper. And I wonder if that isn't the future of this conversation. That stop purchasing range for your upper bound, purchase it for your, I don't know, let's call it mean plus 10%, and then go rent capacity from there. But I mean, this episode, by the way, has spiraled totally out of control from what we were originally going to talk about. But give me 10-second reaction on that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And I actually already do that in a sense. I hadn't thought of it that way. But well, so I drive an electric vehicle, but it's a little oversized. If I were optimizing it the way you said, I probably would drive a plug-in of some sort that just has 25 miles of range because that's about all I normally drive. And what I do is I took my family to Acadia. I have four kids, so a family of six. We had one other guest with us, drove all the way to Acadia, Maine. We rented a Jeep Wagoneer and it was great. And it's actually very easy and very scalable. Yeah, but it's okay. I think for some reason, you know, vehicles are very personal to people. It's part of your identity and it's part of your culture and it's part of the culture of kind of the whole country and other countries as well. It's just an interesting product category. And so it's loaded with all that emotion and brand and everything. But if you look at it very practically, what you said makes complete sense. You just have something that's appropriate to your situation. And it's actually very easy to make that transition work and make the life balance work with an electric vehicle or whatever is the ideal modern technology that works. It just happens to be moving in the direction of electric, in my opinion, and faster than most people think. I just think, I'll tell you one thing, my main takeaway for the electric vehicle thing. First of all, anybody that does the math, most people rarely drive over 200 or 300 miles. I've heard Elon Musk talk about this. I think 300 was really their magic number. Once a vehicle can go about it might have even been 200 miles, it's far enough that it's no longer a constraint on adoption. Even though people think it is, it just isn't. It's just a matter of catching up to that reality. And they're already at that point. And I think people gradually move toward the most practical thing, and it's rapidly becoming that.
I agree. I think regen braking is one of the great unsung wins of, you know, the idea that like you pay to get the car up to 80 miles an hour when you need to slow down or stop. That's not lost value. You're recapturing some of that. I don't know. The cheapskate in me loves that technology. Jeremy Frank, I got no more time today. I don't want to take up any more of yours either. We got to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for coming on and being our last episode of the year.
Yeah, I really appreciate being here and getting to talk to you, Ryan. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy. All right. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in. Join us next time as we talk with another executive about things that went wrong on a journey that went right. Over the Air is presented by Varri, your trusted source for cutting-edge technology solutions. For the latest updates and exclusive content, be sure to follow Over the Air on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else great podcasts are found. On behalf of the team here at Varri, thanks for listening.